From November 2011 to May 2012, I was unemployed. Ashley was a student at the time and earned about $400 a month, but our rent was $450, and not to mention other expenses such as food, utilities, car expenses, etc. Nevertheless, during this seven-month period, we experienced nearly $5,000 in income outside of Ashley's job, and this was no accident. It was the provision of God. I think it could almost go without saying, I was kind of depressed during this time, and both of us felt frustrated. I can infer this mostly because my memories of the time are few and fuzzy, but one thing I do recall feeling is an amazement at how God was providing, even if God chose some odd ways. One day I was driving around applying for jobs. I was traveling south on 19 in a rather rural area when a lady pulled out right in front of me. Instead of rear-ending her, I chose to slide into the ditch and my car got banged up. Her insurance company paid $1,400 for the damage to the car, and we sold the car to my brother for $600, which was a blessing to him too, but that's another story. We took the $2,000 and purchased the car I still have today, and it has proved to be a blessing in cost and as a learning experience, like how to drive stick and turn a wrench. Another time I found a computer at a garage sale for $5. I bought it, kept it, still use it today, and sold the computer I was using for $300. During this time, I sensed God was providing in some extraordinary ways, and so I kept a spreadsheet detailing the extra income. We never knew where the funds would come from next, but we were never disappointed. I think at one point the bank account reached single digits, but I don't ever recall paying a bill late. The church community came around us at this point, both this church here and our small group. The encouragement helped to keep us moving and searching. I keenly felt the words of Hebrews 10, "Let us hold on to the confession of our hope without wavering, for he who promised is faithful. And let us be concerned about one another in order to promote love and good works, not staying away from our worship meetings as some habitually do, but encouraging each other, and all the more as you see the day drawing near." I kept track of where each piece of income came from. But if I thought about it and tried to probe as to a deeper how or why behind the income or the timing of it, the only clear answer was the providence of God. From this experience, I took away this lesson. Caleb, hang your hat on God. Not because he took care of me this one time, but because of how this one time tells me about God's character and person. Even when I don't understand the action, I can believe in the great actor.
Thank you, Caleb, for your willingness to share, for your willingness to bear witness to what God has done for you. Caleb's experience illustrates a couple aspects of the reality that Paul is talking about in 2 Corinthians 8. First, he reminds us that God provides for his children, and in fact, that everything we have is God's provision. Yes, none of the extra money they received simply appeared miraculously out of nowhere. God didn't drop any bags, you know, of dollar bills out of the sky. It could all be tracked to some place. It came from somewhere for a particular reason. But God was in command of all those events. You know, they were not predictable, they were not expected, they were not ordinary. He set each in its proper place, in its proper time, as they had need to meet their needs. And the fact is, God most often works through other people to accomplish his purposes, even when they themselves are not aware of it. You know, it's a lesson I think I learned most clearly. There's a woman Catholic blogger by the name of Jennifer Fulweiler who converted some number of years ago from a fairly diehard sort of atheism, brought her husband along with her, and spent a lot of time working through that development and how God led her along the way. And at one point, actually, it was where I first discovered her blog. A friend of mine was, noting this. You know, she was telling the story of being on her way somewhere. I don't remember whether it's to work or to a job interview, but you know, something important, fairly time critical, and of course she's all dressed up, and the car broke down. And so she had to call, you know, tow truck and get towed and everything else, and she's kind of writing about this later and, you know, venting about it a little bit and trying to figure out, okay, what's God trying to teach me, you know, in this situation? What's God trying to do? You know, what's the purpose of this? And the real punch came one of the comments left on this particular post. Someone wrote back, maybe it wasn't about you at all. Maybe it was about the tow truck driver. And that's resonated with me because very often what God is primarily doing in an event is completely different from what we think the main purpose is. You know, we talked last time about the frustration that those of us who went down, you know, to Indianapolis experienced in, you know, the failure of the mediation to go the way we wanted it to go. But over the course of all of that, you know, we were talking about all kinds of things. And Dr. Kavanaugh ended up with the opportunity to talk for quite a bit to our Ohio lawyer, whose 13-year-old daughter is a cellist, which sounded very familiar to me, about Masterworks. And, you know, we thought that what that whole thing was about was dealing with the legal matter, dealing with the situation of the presbytery, hopefully getting this finished. And I'm sure God has his purposes with regards to that. But I have the sneaking suspicion that for God, the main reason all of this happened, the main reason it was all orchestrated, was to provide an occasion for that conversation. Because if out of all of this, the life of one 13-year-old girl south of Cleveland gets redirected, you know, she gets led into the path that God has ordained for her. From a God's eye point of view, that's more important than any presbytery and anything that we're dealing with. You know, this is how God works. He uses others. He uses us in the lives of others. And he fits it all together in all kinds of ways that are outside our planning and outside our understanding. And I don't know why, you know, he works in this way. I don't know why he chooses to make us his instruments of provision. But at least in part, I think I understand. Because in part, it is a matter of taking us seriously and treating us with respect. Because, you know, I mean, God could easily do everything directly all by himself. I mean, he could have simply rained dollar bills on Caleb and Ashley if he'd wanted to. He could have provided it for them like the manna just coming up from the ground. Would have been really funny to see, but he could have done it. But if God did that, what would we have to do? What would our lives matter? We wouldn't be engaged with God's plan. We wouldn't be on the line. When he brings us in, when he works through us, it makes our actions, our decisions, our lives meaningful. It makes them significant in the context of the work of the kingdom of heaven. And I think that he so often does it in ways that are completely apart from our own plans, like the woman who ended up blessing Caleb by accident, as it were, to help us see that everything that we do, even the smallest thing, you know, even those decisions that aren't really decisions at all, they're just the consequences of we happen to be on the road at this time because it took, you know, an extra minute to brush our teeth, even the smallest details have consequences that ripple out far beyond and far outside anything that we could ever predict or ever understand. You know, it shows us that our lives are important and meaningful far more and far more broadly than what we focus on. And in so doing, it reminds us of just how much bigger than us God is and just how much higher his ways are than our ways. And how much greater his plans than our plans. So that's the first point. And the second, actually, I have to add a little bit here, and I can add a little bit to Caleb's story, because I had a number of long conversations with him and with Ashley, both together and individually, during the period of his unemployment. And certainly I remember they were indeed frustrated and anxious and emotionally low. But the thing that struck me every time is that with all of it, they were firmly committed to following Jesus. And their first focus was on seeking his will and trying to be where he wanted them to be and do what he wanted them to do. Their first concern was to please him. And in truth, as often seems to be the case, I think they may have been more frustrated at some points because of that. I think we can all testify when we've tried to discern God's will for us, when times are tough and the circumstances are murky, that it often seems to us to be something of a profitless venture. We wind up sort of filling our eyes with fog and our mind with mist and don't understand anything better than when we started. Because the fact of it is, what that really boils down to in the end is trying to understand what God's doing in advance, trying to figure out his will so that we can follow it intentionally and deliberately and in a planned and programmed way. And at least in my experience, God doesn't usually let me do that. Usually he just sort of grins at me and says, trust me. But if we're seeking him in that way, if we are open to him and wanting to be where he wants us to be and to do what he wants us to do, what he does consistently do faithfully is guide us in his will, step by step by step. We get the light for each step as we need it. And sometimes we only even realize that we've taken the step as we're looking back. But he keeps us in the path. He keeps us in the way. And he keeps us on his schedule, even if we're way off our own. But the key point is that in everything, their top priority was not themselves and getting more money, but serving Jesus. And God honored that. And he provided them with enough to meet their needs, step by step by step. Not big storehouse of bread, but he gave them their daily bread. Enough for today, enough for the assurance that there would be bread tomorrow. And it's important to note that we shouldn't talk about this as something that he was doing during that time and then Caleb got a job and that was the end of that, because it was God who provided the employment. It was God who brought that together. It's still the Lord's gift. Only the means that he used changed. It didn't stop being God's provision. Simply God brought Caleb and his work and his efforts back into the center of that provision. But through all of it, they made God their priority. They kept their commitment to put him first. And he kept his commitment to them in return. And this is where the scriptures are focused, really consistently, on where our hearts are, what we're seeking, what we're putting first. But it's so easy amid all the noise of the world, and all the obvious stuff, all the stuff we can actually see, all the bottom lines and all the externals, that it's really easy to miss God's focus. But look what Paul says about the Macedonians. These are, in case you're not quite clear, these are the churches of Philippi and Thessalonica and the others in that region. Is Paul boasting about them because they gave a lot of money? No. Fact is, they didn't give a lot of money. We can be sure about that. They were desperately poor. They were suffering under persecution. From the outside, I'm sure Paul looked at them. You can hear it in his tone on the page and said, well, I won't say bless their hearts because we know what that means down south, but, I believe, in their faith, I believe in their commitment, but they just don't have it to give. He didn't go to them to ask them to contribute. They went to him. They went to Paul. And they didn't just give what was extra. They didn't have any extra. They really didn't even have enough. But instead, Yeah, as Paul is passing on to the rich churches, they begged him to be allowed to participate despite their poverty. And then, when they got the chance, they gave abundantly, above and beyond what they could afford. And this is what Paul celebrates. And you notice he underscores that it wasn't just money that they gave. In fact, that's not even what impresses him the most. He says they gave themselves for the Lord's service. They responded to the opportunity to give money to the Jerusalem church, which was also desperately poor and also under persecution. They responded first and foremost by rededicating themselves to God's work, consciously and deliberately putting their lives in His hands. And then out of that commitment of their lives to God, they gave their money to Paul for the care of the saints in Jerusalem. They were able to give ridiculously generously out of their poverty because they understood that the money that they were giving and the money that they were keeping and every other part of their lives really belonged to God. And they understood that God takes care of His own. He takes care of those who belong to Him. Now, there's a lot more that could be said here. I could show you some of the notes I took if you doubt me. But I'll leave you with one last point. Because I said a few weeks ago that godly generosity is a blessing not just to the one who receives, but also to the one who gives. And we see that again here in 2 Corinthians. The Macedonian Christians recognize that all of life is a gift from God. That life itself, all we have, all we enjoy, are God's grace to us, freely given, not deserved, no strings attached. And their awareness that they have received grace motivates them to show grace, to give freely. Grace inspires gratitude, and gratitude feeds generosity. And so they delight in the opportunity to give as freely and open-handedly as God has given to them. And note that they delight to give. I mean, this is what most people call giving until it hurts. But for them, it seems to be more giving until they rejoice. And Paul makes a point of this. And when he notes that their generosity flows out of their abundant joy, he's drawing an implicit contrast to the people he's writing, to the church in Corinth. And you can see it. You can see it, obviously, in this passage. You know, they had nothing. They gave. You were talking about this a year ago. And now I got to be reminding you and kind of dragging you along. But more than that, if you go back and you compare the letters, compare all the letters, it comes through very clearly. I mean, the Thessalonians, they've got a few issues. You know, they got a few folks in the church who figure, well, Jesus is coming soon, I don't need to work. And so Paul says, no, if it won't work, let them not eat. Let them starve for a little while and they'll figure it out and they'll get back to being responsible. But, okay, so they're not perfect. Never met a perfect church yet. Paul's letters to them are full of celebration of their faith, of their growth in Christ, despite, you remember, that Paul had been driven out far earlier than he wanted to leave Thessalonica. There's a deep affection here and a deep delight on his part, you know, that they're growing so strong and that they're so firmly committed to Christ. The Philippians, I mean, they have a painful split in their leadership that's causing some real problems. Again, there's stuff to deal with here. But overall, the church is strong and a radiant witness to Christ, even in the midst of persecution, such that the letter to that church has been called the Epistle of Joy. because that's such a powerful theme in the letter to the Philippians. And then you take those three letters, some correction here, some correction there, but overall a real tilt towards blessing and affirmation. And then you compare them to 1st and 2nd Corinthians, where we see a church that's been given every blessing. I mean, Corinth was a rich city. It was a booming city. You know, persecution didn't happen there until a fair bit later on. It wasn't an issue at this point in time. And it was a church that had been gifted amazingly in the spiritual gifts. They should have had everything going right. They had everything going for them. And instead, what do we see? We see a church that's riddled with conflict and just sick with selfishness and spiritual arrogance and one-upsmanship. They can't even have dinner together without turning it into a competition. Paul has to tell them, when you have communion, don't let the rich get there first and eat up all the food and get drunk and leave the poor out in the courtyard fighting for the scraps. He has to tell them not to blow up their worship services competing to be heard. He has to tell them, you got a guy who's sleeping with his stepmother. This can't happen. You got to get him out of the church. I mean, whatever you want to talk about, sexual sin, desecration of the sacrament, competition over which apostle they were converted by, all of it is claims to spiritual superiority, and half their claims to spiritual superiority being used to say, well, I can do anything I feel like because I'm so spiritual, it doesn't matter what I do. I'm godly anyway. You know, these are people who have not made God their priority. They have made God an excuse to prioritize themselves. They have turned him into an intellectual and spiritual fashion statement. And so it's no wonder that Paul had to cajole them to give. That wouldn't do anything for their egos. Certainly wouldn't give them anything that they could show off. And we see it in all their squabbling. Life in that church seemed to have been an endless competition to be first and to get your own way. They were well off, but they were not joyful. The Macedonian churches put God first, gladly giving beyond their means. And so they were poor and the Corinthians were rich. They were under persecution and the Corinthians were safe. They had nothing to brag about. The Corinthians had nothing but things to brag about. But in the midst of all of it, the churches of Macedonia had what Corinth lacked. They had the joy of the Lord because they understood what so many never learn, that if you give God everything and you make him your number one priority, whatever you may give up along the way, you'll gain far more in the end. Let's pray.